Lyndon Johnson. The most miserable period of my life. From his early 20s, Lyndon Johnson had operated upon the premise that if he could get up earlier and meet more people and stay up later than anybody else, victory would be his. For a decade, he had toiled nonstop. He had no hobbies and had developed no ways to relax. His goal was simply and solely to win. As debate coach, he had led his team to the championship. As secretary to Congressman Richard Clayburgh, he had earned a reputation as the best secretary on Capitol Hill. As the youngest director of any state's NYA, he had instituted projects that served as models for the entire nation. As a freshman congressman, he was touted as a wunderkind for bringing rural electricity to the Hill Country. In his run for a Senate seat in 1941, the most important campaign of his life, he lost. Abraham Lincoln's loss in his first election had neither diminished his hopes nor stifled his ambition. On the contrary, as one familiar with disappointments, he had been heartened by the nearly unanimous vote he had received from those who knew him best, the voters in his own small hamlet of New Salem. Franklin Roosevelt considered his lost vice presidential run a darn good sale, an experience that had expanded his contacts and reputation across the nation. But elections for Johnson were fraught with extra meaning. He felt the Senate loss as a bodily blow, a referendum on his self-worth. He had been weighed by the public and been found wanting. This defeat that should have been merely an obstacle in his political career became for Johnson a life-altering ordeal, changing the nature of his ambition and setting in motion a protracted depression he later described as the most miserable period of my life. How had Lyndon Johnson, Franklin Roosevelt's protege, a man willing and able to work with greater focus and intensity than any of his opponents, failed to secure the Senate seat he coveted with every fiber of his being? Death had once again opened the door to opportunity and advancement. 4 years earlier, a headline spied on a park bench announcing the death of Congressman James Buchanan had led to the start of his congressional career. Now, on April 9, 1941, a brain hemorrhage would strike down the senior senator from Texas, Morris Shepherd, calling forth another special election. Johnson's aide, Walter Jenkins, remembered that when he called Johnson at home to deliver the news early that morning, Lyndon was immediately interested. A cleverly staged scene signaled Lyndon Johnson's launch into the race. On April 22nd, Johnson met privately with Roosevelt, allowing reporters gathered for the president's scheduled press conference to observe the young congressman's entrance and departure from the Oval Office. Shortly afterward, on the White House steps, Johnson formally announced he was running for the Senate. When reporters were ushered into the Oval Office, a genial Roosevelt awaited them. "Lyndon Johnson just announced he is a candidate for the Senate in Texas," one reporter began. "Any comment on that?" With a laugh, the president replied, "He told me, too." "You don't mingle in these state primaries," the reporter said, "but I would like to ask if you look with favor upon Mr. Johnson." "Wouldn't that be mingling if I said yes or no? Have you stopped beating your wife, yes or no?" Roosevelt queried. Laughing along with the president, the reporter countered, "She's away. That's the answer to that." At which point the entire press corps burst into laughter. High spirits prevailed as Roosevelt laid out a three-part recipe. "Now it is up to the state of Texas to elect their own senator. That is number one. Number two, I can't take part in the Texas primary. And number three, if you ask me about Lyndon Johnson himself, I can only say what is perfectly true, that he is a very old and close friend of mine. Now, don't try to tie those things together." From the very start of the campaign, Johnson sought to fuse his image with that of FDR, as if his mentor had not only schooled but hatched the protege. "If you really want to continue and help Roosevelt," Johnson reiterated, "there's only one way to do it. and that's to elect me. 4 years earlier, at Lyndon's first meeting with Roosevelt in Galveston, a picture had been taken showing him reaching over Texas Governor James Allred to shake hands with the president. This photo, with the governor erased from the frame, became the signature image of the campaign, the sloganeering jingle of which was, Franklin D. and Lyndon B. Johnson would need all the presidential boost available, for he faced three formidable opponents, all far better known statewide than he. Popular Governor Lee Pappy O'Daniel, five-term Congressman Martin Dies, and Attorney General Gerald Mann. The enormous scale of Texas, vaster than all the New England states combined, proved challenging for Johnson, whose gifts of persuasion hinged upon making connections on a human scale. In a statewide race, attempt as he might to shake every hand, as if touch alone could convey conviction and extract a vote, the shortness of the special election and the distance he had to cover worked against him and required a frenetic pace that made his speedy handshakes seem mechanical. In his first congressional campaign in the 10th District, he had spoken extemporaneously before hundreds of small groups, winding up presentations in 5 minutes in order to leave 15 minutes for direct talk and contact with individual voters. The 10th Congressional District was one of 20 in which he would now have to campaign, and in the majority of those districts, he was a virtual unknown. Necessity demanded that in each district he speak before the largest audiences possible, separated from the people by a stage. In such formal settings, Johnson betrayed a crippling incapacity to speak naturally. His conception of senatorial dignity compelled him to give hour-long speeches, strike an elevated tone, and steer clear of the raw figures of speech that so enlivened his improvisational delivery. Invariably, the crowds began drifting away before his lackluster speeches drew to a close. The same man, whose tremendously commanding presence could dominate any room he entered, seemed ill at ease when framed by the proscenium of the stage, frozen in place. Lyndon's confidence was further rattled when a series of early polls showed him badly trailing the four-man pack. Apprehension that he might lose began to take its toll upon his body.
"When my mother and wife told me that I was the last man in the race," he recalled, "my throat got bad on me, and I had to spend a few days in the hospital. Those 2 days grew into 2 weeks, then worsened into nervous exhaustion, a condition that the campaign sought to conceal."
"He was depressed, and it was bad," Lady Bird recalled. Once before, a collapse during his first congressional campaign had been followed by appendicitis, setting a clustered pattern of ailments, rashes, colitis, ulcers, inflamed bowels, that political stress would wreak upon his anxious body. His spirits began to lift when a strategy was devised to draw more people to his rallies and minimize his speaking deficiencies. During his time as debate coach, he had created a carnival aura around the events, providing pep rallies, songs, and cheerleading normally associated with athletic contests. What if traditional political rallies were turned into circus-like entertainment, as if the Henley picnic of his youth exploded into a full-blown variety show and review? Such a plan would require a massive infusion of money, which Johnson had access to through wealthy Texans introduced to him by Alvin Wirtz, a group including George and Herman Brown, founders of Brown and Root Construction Company. The Brown brothers put together tens of thousands of illegal corporate dollars, which they categorized as legal fees or bonuses, to their employees, who then made individual contributions to the Johnson campaign. The money allowed the campaign to hire a charismatic radio personality and successful advertising executive to produce and market the theatrical musical events, write the scripts, hire the talent, and transport the 24-piece jazz band and the cast of singers and dancers from place to place. The evenings, billed as patriotic pageants in a time of war,
began with selections from a jazz band attired in white dinner jackets, followed by America the Beautiful and other patriotic songs. With the audience appropriately stirred, Lyndon appeared on stage. Standing in front of a towering image of himself shaking hands with Roosevelt, he shed his coat, rolled up his sleeves, and launched into an extemporaneous talk in which he let his hair down and talked turkey. He promised to be a senator who could get things done. He pledged to do the job President Roosevelt wanted him to do, had indeed asked him to do. The well-advertised climax followed, the foremost reason no one left their seats. Upon entry, every person had been given a raffle ticket. The numbers drawn from a giant bowl on the stage corresponded to defense bonds and stamps worth anything from $1 to $100 for the lucky winners. As Johnson's crowds swelled in size and enthusiasm, his poll numbers followed suit. From a mere 5% at the bottom of the four-man race, Johnson climbed to 20% and then to 30%, and finally, in the last week, he pulled slightly ahead of front-runner Governor O'Daniel. But polls only told a piece of the story. Texas politics at the time was rife with corruption. In certain counties in South and East Texas, the local bosses could deliver whatever votes were needed in a close election. With the money flowing into his campaign, Johnson had easily outbid the others to secure the controlled votes in South Texas. By election day, Johnson was confident of victory. Early returns gave him such a healthy lead that a photograph appeared in the press showing him being carried aloft by campaign workers. It was at this moment that an ebullient Johnson let down his guard and released the purchased precincts that were traditionally withheld until all the official votes were in. The early release widened his margin still further, and by the end of the evening, Johnson was ahead by 5,000 votes, though paper ballots from rural precincts were still trickling in. "Lyndon Johnson captures senatorial election," headlined the McAllen Daily Press. The Dallas News suggested, "Only miracle can keep FDR's anointed out." The next day, that miracle came to pass. A large swath of O'Daniel votes suddenly materialized from counties in boss-controlled East Texas. And because Johnson had revealed the hand he held, the O'Daniel campaign knew precisely the hand they needed to win the election. When all the votes were counted, O'Daniel was declared the victor by a margin of 1,311 votes. As he prepared to return to his seat in the House, Johnson feared a diminution of the respect and affection he had gained over the years in Washington. From his vantage, the psychic landscape of the House he had left was not the same he returned to now in defeat. He felt he had disappointed, even embarrassed, President Roosevelt, who had gone out of his way to support his candidacy. "We gave him everything we could, everything," Roosevelt advisor Tommy the Cork Corcoran recalled. "But he didn't win." So disquieted was Johnson, feeling he had lost favor with the White House, that he refrained from calling on the president. "I felt that I had written too many checks on my rather wobbly account," he confided to Governor Allred. "I had overdrawn, and I did not want a check to bounce back in my face." Eventually, Roosevelt reached out to Johnson and, in a private meeting at the White House, tried to lift Johnson's spirits with a teasing remark. "Lyndon, apparently you Texans haven't learned one of the first things we learned up in New York State, and that is when the election is over, you have to sit on ballot boxes." Despite Roosevelt's continued support, Johnson remained despondent. He was no longer the boy wonder. He no longer saw a limitless future before him. He was simply one of 435 congressmen consigned to remain in a place where everyone, including his overburdened staff, knew he had failed. To consider Lyndon Johnson's 1941 electoral loss as a catalyst for a crucible event on the order of the debilitating depression that led Abraham Lincoln's friends to remove all knives, scissors, and razors from his room. Or the deaths of a wife and mother that confronted Theodore Roosevelt on the same day in the same house. Or the polio that left Franklin Roosevelt a paraplegic and threatened all his dreams seems an exercise in hyperbole. Unless Lyndon Johnson's insecurity and the fusion of his public and private life are taken into account. Politics had consumed Johnson from earliest childhood when he had eavesdropped on the political stories his father swapped with cronies on the side porch. The boy trailed his father through the state house and blissfully accompanied him on the campaign trail. While he momentarily and gratuitously considered leaving public life after his Senate defeat, he had no political alternative but to keep the congressional seat he still retained after the special Senate election loss. Nor could he find solace in his private life, which essentially existed to propel his public life. He had cultivated few pastimes that did not overlap with public affairs. Even the act of eating was essentially gobbling nutrition to move from place to place. Lyndon Johnson ate, drank, and slept politics. In the months after the collapse of his dream of making Illinois an economic model for the country, Abraham Lincoln was able to resume the practice of law, a profession that provided the camaraderie for which his gregarious nature yearned, while also giving him time and space to read books, to listen and learn and hone his storytelling skills. Inherited wealth allowed Theodore Roosevelt to purchase land and cattle and build a comfortable ranch in the Badlands, where his depression gradually lifted as he rode his horse 16 hours a day, joined in the 5-week roundups, hunted game, explored the natural world, and transformed his body. Sarah Roosevelt provided the means for Franklin to purchase and develop the treatment center at Warm Springs, where he found the healing he sought in the persona of Doc Roosevelt, head counselor and spiritual director of a unique therapy program that combined work with play, restoring in polio patients the optimism and the sense of fun that he himself had never lost. Each of these three men emerged from a catastrophic turn of fortune with an enlarged capacity for leadership. But what if adversity leads to a darkening of temperament, to mistrust and anger? What if grief and loss result in a shrinkage of genuine empathy and give way to a single-minded drive to accumulate power and wealth? Such was the case with Lyndon Johnson. The loss exposed and magnified negative aspects of his nature that would compromise his leadership until a massive heart attack renewed old priorities, reset his course, and re-established the determination he had first shown at Cotulla to use the power he accumulated to better the lives of others. The tailwind Franklin Roosevelt supplied young Lyndon in his first congressional term had obscured a fundamental mismatch between the institutional structure of the House of Representatives and the leadership gifts Lyndon Johnson possessed. President Roosevelt's interest, access, and tutelary spirit had bestowed upon the freshman congressman an opening to be productive in a deceptively swift and impactful way. Upon his return to Congress after the failed Senate bid, with the president increasingly preoccupied, distracted by the ever-enlarging world war, Johnson was left adrift in an organization that proved increasingly uncongenial to his temperament. The Congress of the 1940s rewarded a slow and steady accretion of power within a seniority system based solely on longevity. Key congressmen had invested years, even decades, to facilitate their rise to leadership positions. In such an institution, one requiring an extended period of resigned waiting, Johnson's strengths, his instinctive ability to seize an opportunity, his capacities to work harder and faster than anyone else, were neutralized. Simply put, the House was no institution for a young man in a hurry. Sam Rayburn had been in the House for a quarter of a century before becoming Speaker at the age of 58. Fear of dying young
exacerbated Johnson's characteristic sense of urgency. Johnson men shared a history of heart disease. Lyndon's father's health had begun to decline when he was in his mid-40s. He had suffered his first heart attack in his mid-50s and died days after his 60th birthday. His Uncle George, who had secured Lyndon's teaching job at Sam Houston High, had died from heart disease at 57. If family history held true, Lyndon could not afford to spend decades moving upward at a snail's pace. The size of the house also played against Johnson's strengths. The membership, which continually changed after biennial elections, made it difficult for Johnson to build the network of personal relationships that had always been the nucleus of his power. His physical size, his encroachment, and determined force of will had given Johnson an insuperable advantage in the context of face-to-face relations. "I always believed," he said, "that as long as I could take someone in the room with me, I would make him my friend." The greater the distance from his audience, however, the more diluted, stifled, and ineffective he became. His ability to fathom people's desires and motivations depended upon repeated, informal exchanges that were not the norm in a body of 435 representatives, separated into different office buildings, protected by ever-enlarging staffs. Nor, given Johnson's discomfort in addressing large audiences, was he able to establish a national reputation by speaking out on various issues and participating in floor debates. "Some of us were on the floor all the time, fighting for liberal causes," a representative from California recalled. "But he stayed away from the floor, and while he was there, he was very, very silent." Johnson did, of course, continue to service his constituents, but these routine duties no longer gratified his relentless ambition. "I always had the feeling he was a little restless," his fellow Congressman O.C. Fisher recalled, "looking for bigger worlds to conquer." Indeed, Johnson viewed the 7 years he spent in the House between 1941 and 1948 as a kind of purgatory. Not surprisingly, Johnson's enervation and diminished interest in the job adversely affected his relationship with his staff. Fits of depression were punctuated by angry outbursts in which he blamed anybody or everybody for his loss, historian Randall Woods writes. His abusive behavior worsened. "One day I didn't get a telephone number fast enough for Mr. Johnson, and he threw a book at me," recalled a female staffer. "I was a little afraid of him after that." Even before the Senate run, Johnson's two longest-serving aides, Luther Jones and Gene Latimer, had quit. Jones knew after less than a year on the House staff that he simply had to get away or be devoured by Johnson. Latimer lasted exactly a year to the day of his arrival. "I was literally working myself to death," he recalled. "I never took a breath." Johnson quickly replaced Jones and Latimer with able men, but without the inspiration of Johnson's intensely focused energy, without the thrill of shared engagement in important beneficial projects, the new team never achieved the camaraderie that had bound the older team together, despite their volatile and oppressive chief. Though never driven before by the dream of amassing wealth, Johnson began to devote more and more of his time and energy to its acquisition. After a stint in the Navy in the wake of Pearl Harbor, he bided his time in Congress, relegated constituent matters to his staff, and spent his days pursuing the accumulation of what would, before a decade had passed, become a massive fortune. Money, its erratic comings and goings, had been a significant player in Lyndon Johnson's family from the beginning. The vicissitudes of his father's business dealings had brewed dissension and insecurity from Lyndon's childhood years, influencing the sometimes humiliating figure the Johnson family cut in town. Lyndon Johnson's multimillion-dollar empire was planted by Lady Bird in 1943 with the purchase of KTBC, a shabby radio station operating on the verge of bankruptcy in Austin, Texas. No sooner had Lady Bird secured this tiny station for the sum of $17,500 from her trust fund than the Federal Communications Commission rained its blessings upon the enterprise
permitting an increase in transmitting power, expanding its hours of broadcast to a full 24 hours a day, disallowing all competition, and granting network affiliations. The sum of all these advantageous rulings led finally to a lucrative television contract that begot further investments in bank securities, real estate, and cattle. Like two young oaks springing up side by side, a Wall Street Journal reporter summarized, LBJ's careers in government and business grew mightily, their trunks rising parallel and branches intertwining. To juxtapose Lyndon Johnson, the principal of the elementary school at Catula, who had spent a significant amount of his meager salary in order to buy athletic equipment and furnish a playground for his Mexican-American students, with the congressman whose rightward political drift accelerated as his wealth increased, underscores the loss of bearings he had experienced in the traumatic aftermath of his Senate loss. The ambition to better the lives of others that had given his life direction and meaning during his early years in politics, his work with the NYA, his fight for slum clearance and rural electrification, was now focused solely on himself. He had lost the sense of purpose that had accompanied his drive for power, the doubleness of ambition so central to genuine leadership. Lyndon Johnson's loss of bearings grew more marked upon the death of his greatest political mentor, Franklin Roosevelt. When a U.S. Senate seat opened in 1948, he resolved to make one last try to reach the upper house. As he prepared for the statewide run in an increasingly conservative Texas, he shifted still further to the right, even repudiating his former allegiance to the New Deal. "I think the term New Dealer is a misnomer," he told a reporter. While he still believed in the development of water power and in some of the programs Roosevelt backed, he said, "I believe in free enterprise, and I don't believe in the government doing anything that the people can do privately. Wherever it's possible, the government should get out of business." Though he had waited 7 years for this opportunity, the 40-year-old Johnson was filled with trepidation. This time there was no safety net of a special election. It was all or nothing. A loss would forfeit his congressional seat with its decade of accrued seniority and lock him out of official Washington for the first time since his 20s. "I just could not bear the thought of losing everything," he confessed, as if his identity was contingent upon his position and standing. Friends and relatives prodded him to enter, but he remained indecisive. Tired of waiting, a group of his associates suggested that he convince his former congressional aide, John Connolly, to make a bid. That afternoon, Johnson announced that he was running for the United States Senate. Once again, the elevated stress that elections invariably brought Lyndon began to surface in an array of physical ailments, fevers, chills, stomach pains, headaches, depression, even kidney stones. "You have to realize that a politician, a good one, is a strange duck," Johnson told campaign worker Joe Phipps. "Anyone who periodically has to get down on hands and knees to beg voters to prove they love him by giving him their vote is really sick. Depending on how obsessed he is, he could be very, very sick. Try to think of me as a seriously ill, dear relative or friend who needs all the care, compassion, comfort, and love he can get in order to get well, knowing that in time he will get well. The illness won't come back till the next election rolls around." Johnson's chief antagonist, Coke Stevenson, a celebrated two-term Texas governor, was at the beginning of the race the prohibitive favorite. In the one-party state of Texas, however, where the winner in the Democratic primary was assured of victory in the fall, the campaign revolved around personalities. And no personality was more original than Lyndon Johnson. On the trail, he worked 20 hours a day, shaking hands, making short speeches, giving radio interviews. "He even worked in the bathtub," his secretary Dorothy Nichols recalled. "You'd be in a little hotel in this little town, and you'd get a summons to come into the bathroom to talk to the congressman. You'd go in, and he'd be in the tub, and he would talk to you, and two or three secretaries would come in and take letters. He never stopped.
Understanding the importance of flamboyantly seizing the attention of the electorate, Johnson crisscrossed the state in a helicopter, something no candidate had previously done. The helicopter, dubbed the Johnson City Windmill, was just the vehicle to draw astonished voters from far-flung corners of Texas. Much as young Franklin Roosevelt had stormed from barns to hayfields in a bedecked red Maxwell in his first campaign for the state Senate, so now Lyndon Johnson combined fun, hokum, and excitement with the techniques of a modern campaign, complete with advanced men, sophisticated polling, and radio advertising. Circling the town square or the local football field, he would blast his arrival over the PA system attached to the helicopter runners.
"This is Lyndon Johnson, your next United States Senator, and I'll land in just a minute. I want to shake hands with all of you."
If the town lacked a proper landing site, he would consult a list of voters from the different small towns and villages who had written him over the years.
"Hello there, Mr. Jones," his voice would boom overhead. "This is your friend, Lyndon Johnson. I'm sorry we can't land today, but I want you to know that I'm up here thinking of you and appreciate your kind letter and comments. I just want you to be sure and tell your friends to vote for me at election time."
On election day, the results were so close that neither candidate was able to declare victory. Both held back, playing the same game of undercounting, overcounting, withholding, and opportune releasing. This time, however, the Johnson campaign played the shrewder hand. In 1941, an overconfident Johnson, anxious to capture headlines of victory the next day, had released the votes in his bought precincts prematurely. In 1948, "We learned better," Johnson's aide Walter Jenkins recalled. "While the Cocksure-Stevenson campaign released their votes early, we didn't rush the people in the counties where we had strong votes. We rather hoped they would hold back until the very last moment. That way, if any sort of fraud was involved, it would be too late for the Stevenson campaign to retaliate." "They were stealing votes in East Texas," Johnson supporter and Austin Mayor Tom Miller recalled. "We were stealing votes in South Texas. Only Jesus Christ could say who actually won it." But Jesus wasn't counting, and by an 87-vote margin, landslide Lyndon attained the Senate seat he had coveted for so long. By that mere 87 votes, Lyndon Johnson had gained entry to a wholly different institution with different dynamics of power than the House, one far more contoured to his temperament and formidable leadership gifts. Smaller, more intimate, less procedure-bound, and more stable, given the 6-year tenure in the Senate rather than the 2-year turnover in the House. The Senate was ideally adapted to a leader whose ability to persuade, charm, subdue, and overwhelm depended upon intimate encounters, engaging people face-to-face or in small groups. The Senate's folkways and unwritten rules of the game called upon freshman senators to serve a period of apprenticeship, show deference to their elders, refrain from speaking too often on the floor, concentrate on learning the expected norms of behavior, habits of mind Johnson had long cultivated. Had he become a senator in a different era, he might not have been able to exercise his unique leadership talents to full effect. His diminished ability to speak effectively in formal settings, for example, would have made it challenging to achieve recognition during the Senate's golden age, the decades leading up to the Civil War, when the upper chamber debated the central issues of the day and great orators became the nation's eminent figures, Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, and William Henry Seward of New York. The Senate Johnson now entered was perfectly suited to his trademark leadership style. As aide George Reedy said, Lyndon was the right man in the right place at the right time. No sooner had Johnson arrived than he set about figuring out the structural machinery of the institution. It quickly became apparent to the freshman senator that power resided in an informal coalition an inner club of Southern Democrats and conservative Republicans. A bargain had been struck whereby the conservative Republicans would vote with the South against civil rights legislation, and in return, the Southern Democrats would oppose liberal social and economic measures. Conceived in the struggle to defeat Roosevelt's court-packing plan, which ironically catapulted Johnson into Congress, this coalition had solidified its authority over the years by securing strategic committee chairmanships and displaying a keen and imperious parliamentary acumen. The undisputed leader of this inner club, commanding the respect of almost every member of the Senate, was Richard Russell. From the beginning, Johnson recognized Russell's mentorship would be the linchpin to his hopes of gaining influence in the Senate. He was, of course, not alone among his freshman colleagues in recognizing Russell's unique position in the Senate hierarchy, but he alone set in motion a strategy to ingratiate himself with the courtly senior senator. "The way you get ahead in the world, you get close to those that are the heads of things," Johnson had told his college roommate when he took a job mopping floors in the hallway outside the president's office. Shortly after his Senate entrance, Johnson realized there was only one way to see Russell every day, and that was to get a seat on his committee. Without that, we'd likely be passing acquaintances and nothing more. So I put in a request for the Armed Services Committee. And fortunately, because of all my work on defense preparedness in the House, my request was granted. Though the two men were wildly dissimilar in temperament and style, they shared a consuming devotion to work. The Senate was the bachelor's entire existence. Russell embodied the Senate much the way Rayburn embodied the House. Lyndon Johnson respected, loved, dutifully served, and thoroughly exploited both mentors. He understood the anxiety and loneliness both men experienced when they were away from work. "Russell found in the Senate what was for him a home," Johnson explained. With no one to cook for him at home, he would arrive early enough in the morning to eat breakfast at the Capitol and stay late enough at night to eat dinner across the street. And in these early mornings and late evenings, I made sure there was always one companion, one senator, who worked as hard and as long as he, and that was me, Lyndon Johnson. On Sundays, the House and Senate were empty, quiet, and still. The streets were bare. It's a tough day for a politician, especially if, like Russell, he's all alone. I knew how he felt, for I too counted the hours till Monday would come again, and knowing that, I made sure to invite Russell over for breakfast, lunch, or brunch, or just to read the Sunday papers. He was my mentor, and I wanted to take care of him. The central decision an aspiring senator makes is how to spend time and resources to determine what kind of role he might choose to fill. A spokesman on national issues, a regional leader, an expert in a specific field. Johnson aimed to secure a leadership post in the operation of the party itself, beginning with the admittedly insubstantial post of assistant party leader, known as the party whip. With effort and luck, he might transition to party leader. Most senators in the late 1940s and early 1950s shunned these official positions, which, given the entrenched power of the inner club, were largely symbolic. Moreover, the time-consuming duties of corralling votes kept party leaders trapped in Washington, vulnerable to opposition at home. It was not coincidental that in 1950 both the Democratic Party whip and the Democratic minority leader were defeated for re-election. Acting with his usual dispatch, Johnson sought to seize upon the opening chance provided and thrust himself forward for party whip. Recognizing a potential others had overlooked, he extravagantly beseeched Russell for the job he called one of the most urgently desired goals of his life. In 1951, with Russell's support, he became the youngest party whip in history. 2 years later, when the post of minority leader opened through yet another re-election defeat, he launched a characteristic Quicksilver campaign and, despite initial opposition from liberals, was unanimously elected. In every leadership position thus far attained, Johnson had understood the importance of achieving a bold and eye-catching beginning. This time he inaugurated a dramatic shift in the way committee assignments were awarded. Sensing a building resentment on the part of freshman senators who were prevented by seniority from important committees, he persuaded Russell and his fellow coalition members to promise each new senator at least one choice committee assignment. While this required a slight modification of the seniority rule, Johnson convinced the inner circle that the present system stifled energetic young talent that could benefit the Senate as a whole. With this single change, Johnson promptly gained the favor and gratitude of all the freshman senators, who henceforth considered him their patron. Having made inroads to win the backing of junior senators, he was careful not to slight the seniors. On the contrary, he catered to the older senators, as he had always catered to his elders. He assisted them with committee preparations, provided concise summaries on issues, showed overt and lavish respect. As age slowed them down, they feared humiliation. They craved attention. And when they found it, it was like a spring in the desert. Their gratitude couldn't adequately express itself with anything less than total support and dependence on me. And besides, I always like to spend time with older people. In the months following his election as party leader, Johnson exponentially expanded his ability to convert operating and procedural tasks into sources of genuine power. Intuitively, he had fathomed the potential in the commonplace functions of messenger, gatekeeper, and appointment maker. According to rules, the party leader was responsible for scheduling bills for floor debate. Johnson assumed this taxing task with alacrity. If a colleague required prompt action on a pet bill or wanted to delay a controversial vote, he would seek Johnson's assistance. Another workaday job he transformed into an influential resource was discovered in a loophole in the Senate rules that enabled him to transfer the responsibility of assigning office space from the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration to the party leader's office. Before long, a marked hierarchy of choice accommodations in the new Senate office building belonged to Johnson's allies. Those antagonistic to him were relegated to the smaller, older office building. At the core of Johnson's success in the Senate, however, was his celebrated ability to read character, to gauge the desires, needs, hopes, and ambitions of every individual with whom he interacted. If Theodore Roosevelt's speed of learning in the state legislature had astonished witnesses, those who watched Lyndon Johnson in his early years in the Senate were positively boggled. In short order, Johnson was able to memorize the entire institution, its people, its rules, its traditions. "When you're dealing with all those senators," he explained, "the good ones and the crazies, the hard workers and the lazies, the smart ones and the mediocres, you've got to know two things right away. You've got to understand the beliefs and values common to all of them as politicians, the desire for fame and the thirst for honor, and then you got to understand the emotion most controlling that particular senator." And whatever Johnson learned of his cohorts, he never forgot. Over time, he was able to create a composite mental portrait of every Democratic senator. His strengths and vulnerabilities, his aspirations in the Senate, and perhaps beyond. How far he could be pressured, and by what means, how he liked his liquor, how he felt about his wife and family, and most importantly, how he felt about himself, what kind of senator he wanted to be. As Johnson's mental profiles of his colleagues became more intimate and expansive, his political instincts became nearly unerring. Knowledge of the minutiae of the needs and desires of his colleagues on both sides of the aisle enabled him to assign places in senatorial delegations, gratify one senator's wish for a trip to Paris, and another's desire to shore up his foreign policy credentials by attending the NATO Parliamentary Conference. Senators incurred debts large and small to Johnson, debts that would be owed for future collection. At every step of his drive for power within the Senate, Johnson was aided by what one reporter called the biggest, the most efficient, the most ruthlessly overworked, and the most loyal personal staff in the history of the Senate. Working with Johnson was never easy, George Reedy recalled. He could be a magnificent, inspiring leader at one moment, an insufferable bastard the next. He was cruel, even to people who had virtually walked the last mile for him. Occasionally, he would demonstrate his gratitude for extraordinary services by a lavish gift, an expensive suit of clothes, an automobile, jewelry for the women on his staff. But such gifts were often prelude to an additional outpouring of invective, and as always, the staff members were required to drop everything to wait upon him and were expected to forget their private lives and his interests. At regular intervals, Reedy would contemplate resigning, but then Johnson would do something so superb that he forgot his grievances. When Democrats, by a single vote, gained a majority in the upper chamber in 1955, the 46-year-old Lyndon Johnson was elected the youngest majority leader in the history of the Senate. With a quiver full of arrows, unflagging energy, guile, single-minded determination, a politician's ability to link names, people, and events, executive drive, entrepreneurial flair, beguiling storytelling gifts, he had reached the summit of congressional legislative posts. Newspaper reporters painted a picture of a surpassing political mechanic capable of starting what was stalled, keeping the whole legislative machine humming without rancor and without overheating. If at last Lyndon Johnson was sitting on the top of the world, the road to get there had taken a drastic toll. During a press conference summing up the Senate's work in the first half of the year, he blew his stack completely. He screamed, "God damn you," at a reporter who had asked a question he resented. "You can get the hell out of here." The press conference was shattered. Members of the press corps left stunned. Though members of his team had witnessed Johnson's fabled irascibility behind closed doors, he had generally been able to tamp down his temper in public venues. Plagued with an odd lethargy, indigestion, and accelerating stress, Johnson finally decided to take a rare hiatus from work to spend the 4th of July weekend at the Middleburg, Virginia country estate of his good friend and benefactor George Brown. On the 2-hour ride to Middleburg, "My chest really began to hurt," Johnson recalled, "as though I had jacked up a truck and the jack had slipped and the truck had crushed my chest in." Fortunately, another guest, who himself had suffered a heart attack, recognized the symptoms. "My God, man, you're having a heart attack." An ambulance transported Johnson to Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington, the nearest major cardiac unit. A long-term friend of Johnson's, Posh Altorf, rode with him in the ambulance. "It was a very hectic ride. It hurt him desperately," Altorf recalled. "I think he definitely felt there was a possibility that he'd die before we got there. But throughout the ordeal, Johnson remained extremely courageous and brave," adding, "if he had a toe ache, he'd complain and expect a great deal of sympathy. He was just the opposite with this serious thing." Lady Bird awaited his arrival at the hospital, where he went into shock, hovering between life and death. Each passing day greatly increased his odds for survival, but the doctors told the press that the majority leader's immediate return was absolutely out of the question, that he could not undertake any business whatsoever for a period of months. An Associated Press headline blared, "Heart attack drops Johnson from White House hopefuls." Political chatter speculated that the heart attack had not only extinguished the prospect of his running for the presidency, but that he might not be able to resume the burdensome role of majority leader. The upward trajectory of his career was interrupted and perhaps brought to an end. Johnson fell into a depression so consuming that it appeared he was grieving over his own death. The depth of his despondency was measured by the crushing descent from the eminence he had achieved. Everything he held dear was at hazard, his present attainments, his future ambitions. This was different in degree from the depression one might expect after a heart attack.
He'd just sort of lie there, Reedy recalled. You'd feel that he wasn't there at all, that there was some representation of Johnson alongside of you, something mechanical. Then one day he got up and he hollered to have somebody come up and give him a shave, and just in a matter of minutes, the whole damned hospital started to click. He took over the corridor, installed a couple of typewriters there. He was dictating letters. He was just going full speed. What had reanimated him from his corpse-like state? The crucial tonic, it soon became clear, was not administered by the doctors and the nurses, or even by the round-the-clock ministrations of Lady Bird. What animated him was the spate of more than 4,000 letters of concern, condolence, and love. He'd read them over and over and over again, Reedy remembered. Oh, he was just basking in those letters. Finally, it got to the point where we couldn't let them all in his room. There wouldn't have been enough room for him. The letters, Johnson exulted, showed that everybody loves Lyndon, and they kindled in him a fierce need to reciprocate that love. Just as he would answer constituents immediately, so he rose to action now to reply to every single letter. He needed reconnection to these people. Stenographers were installed in the physician's station in the hospital corridor. The typewriters were going non-stop. The 17th floor became a hive of activity. The letters did not merely occupy his time, entertain, or distract him. They invigorated him, as would life-giving transfusions. "Time is the most valuable thing you have. Be sure you spend it well," had been a favorite, oft-repeated adage of Johnson's. Now, however, it took on a sharper urgency. He had always been a most excessive, immoderate man. Ceaseless striving, a chronically strained metabolism, an appalling diet of whatever he was able to consume in the gaps of his maniacal schedule, could now be fatal. It was necessary that he curb a lifetime of habits. In his 6-month period of convalescence at the ranch, a healthy diet replaced breakfasts of 4 cigarettes and black coffee, dinners of fried steaks and fried potatoes. He exercised daily in a newly built swimming pool, drank less bourbon, lost 40 pounds, and took regular naps. He endeavored to walk more slowly and somewhat assuage the excitable tempo of his speech. He spent more time with his wife and children and even behaved in a gentler or at least less demanding fashion toward his staff. To counter the gossip in the press that he might not have the stamina to return to the political cauldron of the majority leadership, he launched a campaign for public consumption, spinning the narrative of a man whose entire mode of living had been altered. This included a thoroughgoing philosophical change most succinctly expressed in a magazine article, "My Heart Attack Taught Me How to Live." He portrayed himself as a new man, leading a well-rounded and meditative life, reading Plato and American history, listening to classical music, taking pleasure in the natural world of the Pedernales, his ranch, and its animals. When reporters and interviewers came to the ranch, they found him sprawled on a hammock, holding a book, as Strauss waltzes floated into the air, a stage set complete with soundtrack and arranged props. Yet beneath this contrived projection, a bona fide metamorphosis was taking place. Death had brushed hard against him, and beneath the calculations of a public relations machine, he was struggling mightily within himself. Johnson's New Deal friend Jim Rowe had sent him a recently published biography on Lincoln, which detailed the profound change Lincoln had undergone during a waiting time when he was out of politics. This was Johnson's waiting time, a time of gathering strength and direction. When Lincoln had suffered his deep depression, he had asked himself, "What if I died now? What would I be remembered for?" Coming back from the brink of death, Johnson asked himself a similar set of questions. He had laid the foundation of a substantial fortune, but what purpose did that serve? He had learned to manipulate the legislative machine of the Senate with a deftness and technical expertise without parallel in American history. But to what end did one accumulate such power? Regardless of one's impressive title, power without purpose and without vision
was not the same thing as leadership. As the January opening of the new congressional session drew near, the date doctors designated for the convalescent's earliest return to Washington, Johnson made plans to deliver a major public speech that would display his physical and mental readiness to resume full command of the Senate. The time and site for his formal reemergency in the public eye were chosen, the late November dedication of the Lake Whitney Dam at the National Guard Armory in the lakeside community of Whitney, Texas. Though the town itself was tiny, the armory had a seating capacity of 5,000, which the advance team intended to pack with people from all over the state, making it a matter of honor for everybody to show their joy that Lyndon was back. All through November, with George Reedy's help, Johnson nervously worked on the speech. Though fully aware of his disabling inability to deliver an effective formal speech, he was determined to show that he was back in the saddle again. Indeed, that was the song chosen for his introduction. Of even greater importance, he had decided to use the speech as an occasion to rededicate himself to the values that had originally drawn him into public service, the idea that government should be used to help those who needed help, the poor, the undereducated, the ill-housed, the elderly, the sick. "We've got to look after these people," his father had repeatedly told him. "That's what we're here for." He had returned from this crucible of a massive heart attack with a renewed allegiance to his father's plain-spoken counsel, resolved to act upon it while he had the time, and if he had the chance. Just as Franklin Roosevelt had obsessively rehearsed and trained before the 1924 convention speech that would mark his first public appearance since he had been stricken with polio, so Johnson called Reedy every 3 minutes to switch "and" to "the" or "the" to "and," just the most incredible nitpicking stuff. It had to be retyped each time. My poor secretary retyped that goddamn speech so much that her fingers were still flying when she went to bed at night. "He even rewrote it as we drove from the ranch to Whitney," Mary Rather recalled, "and I had to type it again at the last minute." In the speech, the man who had renounced his allegiance to the New Deal and soft-pedaled his views on civil rights in order to remain viable in an increasingly conservative Texas laid down a powerful call to arms, a boldly progressive agenda that set a clear direction for the approaching congressional session that would mark the national dimension of his leadership for the first time. He demanded enlarged Social Security coverage, increasing tax exemptions for low-income groups, federal subsidies for education and housing, a constitutional amendment to eliminate the poll tax, liberalization of immigration, public roads and water conservation, and embedded in the midst of this liberal barrage, a single reactionary thorn, a natural gas bill for moneyed Texas conservatives. Billed as a program with a heart, the speech showed that the resurgent Johnson advocated a social vision beyond anything the likely Democratic presidential nominee, Adlai Stevenson, was proposing. "I had never before seen him take such complete command of an audience," George Reedy remembered of that electric moment. On several occasions, the audience leapt to their feet, clapped their hands, stamped their feet, beat on the tables, and whistled to show their approval. The compassion he felt for the marginalized, the badly educated, the badly housed, fueled his delivery in such a way that he sounded like Joshua ordering the trumpets blown at Jericho. Once he was done with his prepared text, he stepped away from the rostrum and with renewed assurance addressed the audience extemporaneously. "People walked out of that speech dazed," Reedy said, "stunned by the amount of emotion that he put into it and the fire." Since the entire National Press Corps was present for the majority leader's first public appearance, the speech received widespread coverage. On this single speech, he had rolled the dice, and his emotional charge had affected every newspaper man that was there. Liberal icon Hubert Humphrey declared, 12 home runs and one strikeout, a very fine batting average." Humphrey especially noted the call for elimination of the poll tax, which would give some forward action at last in the civil rights struggle.
Johnson had not only demonstrated his physical readiness to lead through the impassioned conviction of his delivery, he had shown a deep resolve to move both his state and the country forward on a more progressive path. With clarified purpose, the prodigal son of the New Deal had returned. Lyndon Johnson had no sooner resumed his role as Senate Majority Leader in January 1957 than he committed himself to the passage of a civil rights bill. For 82 years since the passage of the 1875 Enforcement Act, though various civil rights measures had survived the House, the Southern Bloc and the Senate had used the filibuster to keep the door to the passage of any civil rights bill firmly shut. A sequence of events had created a new urgency for legislative action. The Supreme Court's 1954 Brown v. Board of Education decision prohibiting racial segregation in public schools had quickened the civil rights movement, incited a violent reaction in the South, and prompted the Eisenhower administration to send a bill to Congress expanding federal authority to protect black citizens in a wide range of civil rights, including voting rights. Passed by the House the previous year, the bill landed on Johnson's desk for consideration in early January. Despite the long historical track record of failure, he told friends that before summer's end, he would carry a civil rights bill safely through the Senate for the first time in more than three quarters of a century. As he studied the initial Republican bill passed by the House, he understood at once that as written, like every other bill sent to the Senate over the past decades, it was dead on arrival. According to witnesses, he ran his pen twice through one section and made certain alterations in other sections before predicting, "This will be it in the end." The plot line, he understood at once, had to unfold in three acts. In Act One, Johnson had to convince Richard Russell, his mentor and the leader of the Southern Bloc, that a filibuster would gain a Pyrrhic victory for the South. The growing momentum of the civil rights movement suggested that it was only a matter of time until a two-thirds vote could be gathered to secure cloture, and then there'll be no way of putting a brake on all sorts of wild legislation. Moreover, a successful attempt to kill the bill would plunge the Senate into paralysis and prevent action on the South's most fundamental problem, economic stagnation. If the South accepted the inevitability of small incremental progress on civil rights, it might well become one of the most prosperous regions in the country. If it refused to move forward, it would remain an economic backwater. He promised Russell he would remove any mention of social or economic integration, limiting the bill solely to the protection of voting rights. He pledged to remove the part giving the president power to send federal troops to the South to enforce the bill's provisions, and he would work to secure a jury trial for any Southerner indicted for violating black rights, a gambit that stacked the deck heavily in favor of the accused. For the time being, Russell agreed to hang fire and let the debate proceed, knowing that if Johnson failed to deliver on his promises, the filibuster would commence. Act Two featured the mountain states in the West, where the minuscule black population exerted scant sway. While most of these senators supported civil rights, they had less to lose than their colleagues in the North by working toward a compromise. It was in this region that Johnson hoped to find sponsors for the amendments he needed to reshape the bill, and for this objective, he was willing to barter. For nearly a decade, Western Democrats had struggled to secure federal support for a dam at Hell's Canyon near the Idaho-Oregon border that would supply inexpensive public power for the entire region. The Eisenhower administration and their conservative allies in the South had opposed the bill, asserting that private industry should finance the project and control the rates. In an overtly political deal, Johnson persuaded the Southerners to vote for the Hell's Canyon Dam if the Mountain State senators worked with him to delete the most objectionable provisions of the pending civil rights bill. All the while, Johnson remained in the cloakroom or on the floor, moving from one group of senators to another, correcting, mollifying, blunting extreme statements,
preventing the conflict from being cast in irreconcilable terms, ensuring that bargains made were bargains kept. No sooner had the bill for the Hell's Canyon Dam passed than the Mountain State senators, to the surprise of their northern colleagues, took center stage in the civil rights debate. Senator Clinton Anderson of Wyoming stood on the floor to offer an amendment that limited the bill to voting rights and excised the president's power to send federal troops to enforce the bill's provisions.
"I want to see a civil rights bill passed by the Senate," Senator Anderson said. "This may be the last clear chance the Senate will have in a long time."
The moment Anderson offered his amendment, the ever-vigilant majority leader knew he had attained the necessary coalition. Immediately, he called for the vote, and the amendment passed. A few days later, Wyoming's junior senator Joseph O'Mahony and Idaho's Frank Church took to the floor to introduce an amendment providing defendants accused of violating voting rights the right to a jury trial. With the passage of that additional amendment, Johnson had the only bill that had a chance of soldering the three regions of the country together. There still remained Act III, the challenge of persuading northern senators that an admittedly diluted bill was preferable to no bill at all. To be sure, the New York Times editorialized, "By the standards of all those who had hoped for conclusive federal action to enforce the whole range of civil rights, it was a weak bill." Nonetheless, it was the beginning of a curative process in an old national wound. No one understood more clearly than Johnson that the bill was only a preliminary step, but by dealing, however moderately, with the right to vote, it was a necessary and vital step. Speaking on the floor of the Senate, he said,
"A man with a vote has his destiny in his own hands."
Although people spoke of how toothless the bill was, Johnson knew that the fact of the passage was more important than its content.
"We've shown we can do it," he said. "We'll do it again in a couple of years."
On September 9, 1957, the Civil Rights Act of 1957, in almost precisely the form Johnson had envisioned 7 months earlier, became the law of the land. The brand burned into that bill was LBJ's. It was LBJ, newspapers noted, who had stitched together an improbable coalition of Westerners, Easterners, liberal Democrats, and conservative Republicans. It was LBJ who had brought the Senate to pass the bill without the Democratic bloodletting that had been expected, shaping a compromise that persuaded five moderate Southern senators to leave the Confederacy voluntarily to vote with their Northern and Western colleagues. It was LBJ who had opened the